Welcome, subscribers. We are talking to Joseph P. Farrell, and we are continuing our talk from our regular show from earlier. But for this segment, we are going to change gears a bit and dive into a different area of Joseph's work. He has written a three-part series, book series called Giza Death Star, and the two follow-up books are Giza Death Star Deployed and Giza Death Star Destroyed. And Joseph, I frankly don't know that much about this, you know, aspect of your work. So why not kind of start with the, you know, most obvious question of all, I guess. What is the Giza Death Star?
Well, that's the basic and best question to ask. It's my hypothesis is that the Great Pyramid was not only probably a machine, but that it was probably a weapon of some sort, and for that matter, a weapon of mass destruction based on some very, very sophisticated physics principles. Now, once one said that, one is immediately positing the idea or existence of a very sophisticated civilization that would have built it. So, of course, I immediately place myself beyond the pale of normal academic Egyptology by making such a to the ears outlandish assertion.
Yeah, might be a good idea.
I'm positing basically the existence of a precursor civilization of great antiquity that may have built that thing.
So, again, are we back to talking about a weapon here?
Well, it kind of comes from three different points. The first component that got me thinking along those lines was when I was younger, my parents used to travel all over the country on vacations, and one year we traveled across the state of North Dakota, way up by the Canadian border, and off in the distance you could see from the highway that we were on the old phased array radar that had been built for the American anti-ballistic missile system in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And this structure looked kind of like a pyramid with the top lopped off of it. And so the idea kind of lodged in the back of my mind as I was a kid that, well, maybe the pyramids of Egypt, or the Great Pyramid in particular, was something military in nature. Because, of course, the Great Pyramid is from one standpoint of view, obviously a hardened structure.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of percolated in the back of my mind for several years. The second thing that kind of led me on to this was the book I mentioned in the first hour, a book by a British engineer, actually, who lives in this country, by the name of Christopher Dunn. And it's just a marvelous, marvelous book. It's called The Giza Power Plant, and it's an engineer's look at the Great Pyramid and why he thinks it's nothing else other than a machine. And a machine that he himself speculates is based on kind of avant-garde physics principles that he connects to the name of Nikola Tesla. Yeah, and you know, once you've said that, then you know, all the doors of possibilities are thrown open.
Indeed, yeah.
The third line that led me into it was the author Zechariah Sitchin, who of course has published an enormous series called the Earth Chronicles series.
Yeah.
And in the second book of that, a book called The Wars of Gods and Men, he cites an ancient Babylonian text called the Lugal A, and another ancient Babylonian text called The Exploits of Ninurta, which detail the events of a war that were fought, in his opinion, partially with nuclear weapons, in order to destroy a weapon that is called the Great Weapon or the Great Affliction, which in Sitchin's reading is connected and clearly identified with the Great Pyramid. Now, I found that extremely interesting because Sitchin himself does not believe or doesn't pursue his own insight there. He just kind of puts it out there and moves along without really considering the implications of what he said. So, you know, once I put all three of these things together, I started digging a little bit into, well, if this is the case, if it is a machine, why is it that there are things missing in it? And why is it that that this structure really presents evidence to us today as being but the shell of something else. There are clearly components inside the structure that are missing, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I started digging into what the physics could possibly have been, what in contemporary theory might explain its use as a weapon of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really kind of where the three books take off. It's basically an outline of ancient texts, modern physics ideas, and then in the third book some extremely esoteric connections to all of these things.
Interesting. And tell us, if you will, about the do you speculate at all in regards to the civilization who actually might have built these things, ancient one, how many years ago, so forth?
I do to a certain extent, but only insofar in those three books as a kind of what to the extent that's necessary to make the weapon hypothesis that I'm exploring feasible.
Mm-hmm.
In the new book that I mentioned in the first hour, The Cosmic War, I go into the scenario itself quite a bit more and into some of the speculations about the civilization involved. But basically it comes down to this in all of those books. I don't use the term Atlantis of this civilization simply because I try to avoid getting into debates about where Atlantis was located, how long ago was it, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I call it simply the very high civilization. Because it's clear, I think, to many people that the civilizations of ancient India and Sumer and Egypt are legacies of something else. They literally spring up out of nowhere, full-grown, very sophisticated civilizations with a depth of astronomical and mathematical knowledge that's almost stupefyingly sophisticated.
Yeah,
so,
indeed.
You know, it comes from somewhere. I don't speculate as to where. I simply maintain that it's there, and that we ought to take the texts that talk about that civilization and its wars and its technologies seriously. Now, as to the chronology that we're talking about, I think at the minimum, if we take various evidences that I present in the three Giza Death Star books seriously, that the Great Pyramid was built sometime before the biblical flood. If we take those evidences seriously, then that would make the Great Pyramid at a minimum at least 10 to 12,000 years old. It is an incredibly old structure. It's probably the oldest structure on the face of the earth. And the other line of evidence that suggests its antiquity is surprisingly the work that has been done. Your listeners are probably familiar with the work of John Anthony West, Robert Schock,
indeed.
Sphinx. The Sphinx, I think, along with the second big pyramid at Giza, represents kind of a second layer of civilization building there. And a later one, because in Schock's estimation, the Sphinx is, I recall, is between 7,500 and 8,000 B.C. So it represents a considerably later level of civilization that built those structures. And if we put that in the context that most people believe that the Great Pyramid is older than those two structures, then that again would tend to make it an extremely old structure. Now, the thing that I find incredibly interesting about the Great Pyramid, and I get into this a bit in the Giza Death Star books, are the fantastic amount of mathematical and physical analogs that the pyramid has within it, not only to the geometry and physics of the Earth, but to the geometry and physics of the local solar system. And much to my surprise, when I was working out the details of my hypothesis, in order for my hypothesis to be true, I maintain that the pyramid is a harmonic oscillator, which means that, to draw an analogy for your listeners, if one sits at a piano keyboard, an acoustic piano, and presses down any note silently, and then hits the same note an octave or two lower, you'll hear that note that you're pressing silently vibrate sympathetically with the note that you strike. So in order for my idea of the physics involved to be true, I had to find some analog to the constants or coefficients of the constants of quantum mechanics. Now, that may sound just like the wildest speculation that there could possibly be. But as I started playing around with the numbers of some of the dimensions inside of the Great Pyramid, I discovered that in the Grand Gallery in particular, there were just multiple after multiple of the numbers of the coefficient of the Planck length. And that in other cases, there I don't think that in these other cases that it was statistically significant, but there were also analogs of the Planck constant and of the Planck mass. So in other words, this to me just presented a baffling puzzle, because on the one hand, it kind of supported my theory, but on the other hand, it meant that these people not only who built this structure had a sophisticated knowledge of local system astronomy, of basic geometrical constants like pi and phi and so on and so forth, but that these people also had a sophisticated enough physics that they could embody within the numerical dimensions of the structure some of these principles of quantum physics that weren't discovered until 1905. So, you know, whoever built it, it wasn't the Egyptians using logs and sleds.
So, I mean, what do you... Do you kind of get, I guess, I don't know, angry is the right word, but, you know, French architect, what's his name, Jean-Pierre Houdin, I think, the latest guy putting out the theory that the construction of the Great Pyramid was built simply using, you know, an internal spiral ramp. Have you heard about this?
I've heard about it, and to be honest with you, I have to discount it. My whole problem with the sleds theory and the ramps theory is that there have been American engineers and I think a couple of British engineers who've calculated that to build a ramp in order to get blocks up there on the pyramid, the ramp itself is going to be almost as big of a building project as the pyramid.
Indeed, yeah.
And the other problem that this does not solve at all, and no explanation that I have seen by Orthodox standard Egyptologist has really explained this in any way, and that is that the, as your listeners are probably aware, the blocks in the Great Pyramid are so precisely aligned that you cannot even get a penknife blade or a piece of paper or a razor blade in between these things. And in addition to that, these blocks are held together by an extremely thin layer of mortar. Now, to pile difficulty upon difficulty, these blocks are aligned to not only the compass points of the Earth, but to each other with such precision that this precision borders on optical precision. That's how precise the tolerances are. And now, even if we posit the acceptability of a theory that we're using ramps and pulleys and sleds and hundreds of thousands of Hollywood extras barking orders to each other and having human labor haul these things up there and place these blocks, how do we account for the precision, the optical precision of the placement? It's an impossibility.
Interesting.
You know, we cannot achieve, and this is something that Chris Dunn talks about in his book, we cannot achieve the precision tolerances that structure is built with using lasers. So, in other words, the very existence of this structure implies a technological sophistication that we have not yet equaled. That plus the fact that this structure is, without any doubt, a machine of some sort, whether or not one accepts my hypothesis, and I admit that it is a very speculative one, but whether or not one accepts my hypothesis, it is a machine of some sort. So the question then becomes, what is this technologically sophisticated civilization building a machine for, and so on and so forth. It's also positing the existence of an extremely sophisticated physics and technology to begin with.
Do you think that we need to go kind of off planet to explain or find an intelligence behind such an ancient, sophisticated, you know, architecture skill, basically?
I don't discount the possibility at all. And in fact, in the second book, the Giza Death Star Deployed, and in the third book, the Giza Death Star Destroyed, and in the book that's coming out, The Cosmic War, I very specifically connect Giza to some of the artifacts in the Sidonia region at Mars, and to other very extremely anomalous objects in the solar system.
Yeah.
I don't discount that possibility. In fact, I think if we take the text that I examine in the Cosmic War seriously, we have to go off-world. That being said, I don't necessarily think that we have to invoke the alien hypothesis or the extraterrestrial biological entity hypothesis to explain the presence of those structures and anomalies on those other planets. It may be the case, as some of the ancient texts indicate, that there is a human connection to some of these things, and that our own origins may be somewhat different than we suspect. But that being said, you know, you can't rule out some sort of alien or extraterrestrial dealings or presence in this scenario either. And the simple reason is if we take some of these ancient texts seriously, particularly the ones from Mesopotamia, you know, the Bible, some of the Babylonian epics like the Lugal-A or so on and so forth, there are clear allusions in all of those texts to the existence of some other intelligent life form that is not necessarily human, with which humans have been interacting. So you can't rule out that possibility either. It's a very open-ended scenario, really, that I'm developing in these four books.
That seems like a good approach in that sense, because there is, you know, always difficulties in boiling down, you know, and be certain about these
right.
things, especially considering that there have been such an incredible amount of time, you know, between, you know, what we know and you know, what the ancients basically knew, and again, oceans of time between there.
Exactly.
One thing that I do want to kind of squeeze in here is, just as a thought here, you know, considering that we could look at a flower and for example, you know, detect, you know, mathematical beauty, you know, a golden ratio type aspect can be found, you know, within flowers and within plants and all of this. But the question is, you know, is there a conscious intelligence there in the flower? I mean, but if we could, the possibility is, could we apply this kind of to the human level? Let's say that in more ancient times, humanity actually was more connected with the nature, as it were, and because of, you know, the structures that we actually built, we were more in touch with nature, that this actually are reflecting kind of that, you know, the universal mathematical beauty, as it were, and the conscious part of it actually is somewhat taken out, and this more reflects nature than it reflects ourselves. What do you think about that?
I think that probably that is the case. And in fact, in the first book, The Giza Death Star, I examined some ancient Hermetic texts of Egypt from a physics standpoint, and one of the things that pops out of that analysis is precisely the type of thinking that you're describing. I think that there's every indication that if this ancient civilization had this technological and scientific sophistication, I think that one implication of that is that they had a physics and a, for want of a better expression, a biological science that was at a very high level, unified and formally explicit. And, you know, once we've said that, we've said a mouthful, because it opens up areas of connections to recent explorations in the physics of consciousness, in Russian work in biophysics, and so on and so forth.
Sure.
So I think that you're correct to point this out, that there is some sort of connection that's there. I don't think that our science as yet is sophisticated enough to know what the connection is, but I do think it's sophisticated enough to show that it's there.
Interesting, yeah. We have, in the past, you know, in regards to the Great Pyramid, Hawass and the guys down there have been, you know, pondering upon what is known as the Guntum Brink's door. They you know, sent up a robot up the shaft. When was
right.
this? Back 2-3 years ago, I guess, the first time. It might even be more. Your take on it? They're going to send up another robot, I guess, in a few months, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know exactly the date there, but what do you think about the first, you know, the scenario that happened, and what do you think, you know, will happen when they send up a second robot?
Well, you're asking a question there that's really more in the domain that Christopher Dunn has written about, but I know I've spoken with him at a number of conferences together with him, and am familiar with his take on that, and I'm kind of try and answer his question more or less from the way that he has interpreted those explorations.
Mm-hmm.
His take is that Gantenbrink's door, when it was discovered, had of course those two little copper metal shafts that were sticking out of it.
Sure.
And if you read his book very carefully, he speculates that the Great Pyramid, as part of a machine, would have utilized some form of hydrogen inside of the internal chambers of the pyramid for the production of power. And in order to do that, of course, there had to have been knowledge of electricity. And his take on the Gantenbrink's door is precisely that what you see there are the two ends of an electrical circuit. And I think he's precisely correct. And he also, I should point out, when the Gantenbrink's expedition was announced, Dunn went on record as saying that they would find nothing behind the door. And that what they would find is just another empty shaft, and possibly a vertical shaft further up running down into the plateau of Giza itself. And he based that on some very specific engineering considerations that he elaborates in his book and in his lectures.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think, probably, that what they are going to find, if they do this next exploration, is something very similar to what Dunn has described. And I don't suspect that Zali Hawass and the Egyptian Department of Antiquities is going to be terribly forthcoming about it when they do. I don't think that they're going to know exactly what it represents or why it's there. We'll get the usual Egyptological nonsense about, you know, Egyptian religion and pharaohs and afterlife and so on and so forth, and we're going to try and concoct some convoluted explanation for it, because they simply don't want it to be a machine, because if it's a machine, the Egyptians didn't build it.
Yeah, that's the problem right there, exactly.
That's the problem right there.
And there's a, you know, again, there's a huge number of, you know, researchers down there, and you know, a lot of books has been written, a lot of history has been written about this, and again, if we are to all of a sudden, you know, change that, a lot of, you know, people will get out of work, so to speak, and a lot of books has to be rewritten, and that's, I guess, too much of a bother these days. So.
Well, it's true, and it's unfortunate, but,
it
you
is.
Know, the other problem is of course, Egyptian national pride, and rightly so.
Sure.
This is a source of pride for them, and it's a source of a lot of income for them.
Yeah, and go ahead.
To a certain extent, one can appreciate Zali Hawass's position. He's more or less got to maintain that position where he is posted in the Egyptian government. So I don't disparage the man for that at all.
No.
But like you say, if all of these alternative hypotheses are true, or even if only a few of them are true, it requires a massive rewriting of human history.
Indeed. And the political correctness now is ruining the scientific process, in regards to, I've heard that people who you know, state that the pyramids weren't built by Egyptians, that they are being, you know, accused of being, you know, racists or whatever. I mean, it's standing in the way of actually, you know, finding out what really has happened down there, as at least that my own view on it. But
well, I happen to agree with you, and you know, it's to a certain extent extent even worse in the United States and Canada, because mm-hmm. our universities here are so up to their earlobes with all of this political correctness nonsense that one can hardly view the university in this country as a forum for the open exchange of ideas anymore. We have too many vested interests, and there's too much government and corporate foundation grant money at stake to maintain with any academic credibility any alternative hypothesis. It's just not going to happen.
No.
So I think the other thing that it bodes is that the real research, for good or worse, is going to be done precisely in the alternative community.
Indeed. Totally agree. You know, I have to ask you in regards to your books, your names, of course. Has the Giza Death Star been deployed and destroyed?
Yes. In my opinion, the answer to both questions is yes. The scenario that I outline in the Giza Death Star Deployed is basically one of a very ancient interplanetary war. And that, of course, is the scenario I elaborate a little bit further on in the Giza Death Star Destroyed. And then, of course, I explore the scenario itself at some great length in the new book that's coming out. But one question I always get on talk shows when I'm talking about the Giza Death Star, and very often it's a question that people calling in will ask, and that is, all right, has this weapon truly been destroyed? In other words, could someone, so to speak, turn a switch or plug it in?
Exactly, yeah, of course, yeah.
And the short answer is no, because there are things missing from the structure. We can see that for a fact by going into the Grand Gallery and noticing those 27 notches on each side of the gallery as it goes up into the antechamber and then into the King's Chamber. Mm. In all likelihood, those notches contained some sort of components that made the machine work. And again, I'd point your listeners to Christopher Dunn's book or to the first book in the Giza Death Star trilogy for an explanation of what those components were.
Sure, sure.
The short answer is no. Mm. The other missing component is the obvious one, and that's the capstone.
Ah, of course.
So, you know, there's what we see there at Giza is the shell of a machine. And the shell of the machine itself, if one considers all the implications of it, are rather horrifying, in my opinion.
Mm.
I do believe that some weapon was used millennia ago, if not millions of years ago, to explode the planet that used to exist in the asteroid belt of our solar system.
Ah, interesting.
This is where the story begins to get very interesting
and
where it begins to connect with ancient mythology, Babylonian mythology and Norse mythology and Celtic mythology and so on.
Indeed.
Because very clearly these texts speak of some colossally catastrophic event of that sort. But the take in the alternative community has always been to interpret it along naturalist or catastrophist lines, simply an object careening into the solar system that collided with a planet and it blew up.
Sure.
I don't follow that theory because, in my opinion, such an object would still leave orbital eccentricities on the signatures of the orbits of the other planets that I don't believe are there. So the only other alternative, physics alternative that we have, and incidentally it's an alternative that the American physicist and astronomer who's kind of revived this hypothesis of an exploded planet in recent years, his name is Dr. Tom Van Flandern.
Ah, indeed, yeah, I remember him, yeah.
Right. Mm. He, in his book, where he discusses this hypothesis of the exploding planet, actually will come out and say that the other alternative that should be considered is deliberate action, in other words, a war. Now, this to me is kind of where I take off, because the ancient texts that speak of this war are very clear that it is a war. In other words, it's not a catastrophe, it's not comets coming into the solar system and colliding with planets and so on and so forth. They talk about those things, to be sure. But they always talk of them in the context of a war fought by real people using really powerful and horrendous weapons.
Yeah.
And in my examination of the physics that I believe lies behind the Great Pyramid, which I outline in those three books, mm-hmm. is that the only physics that I can discover that would be sufficiently powerful to blow up a planet like that is based on one of two things. It's either based on a scalar type of physics, or it's based on some weaponizable offshoot or versions, if you prefer, of a unified field theory of some sort. So we're dealing with a very powerful physics, and I stress again, it's a physics that would make a hydrogen bomb, you know, that big colossal thing that the Russians set off in the early 1960s. It would make that look like a hydrogen, or make it look like a kitchen match.
Yeah, indeed. I'm looking at an article right here now from Tom Van Flander on metaresearch.org. Which is called the Exploded Planet Hypothesis 2000, and he has, you know, laid forth this kind of formula where he measures the distances between the bodies in our solar system, and you know, between Mars and Jupiter. Then there is a question mark, you know, actually that according to the law of how the planets are, you know, equally divided, I guess, or spaced as it were in our solar system, there is a spot, you know, missing between Mars and Jupiter. So I mean, this is a very, very interesting, you know, theory indeed.
Well, I get into that law. It's actually an ancient astronomical, well, not ancient, but an old astronomical law called the Titius-Bode law. Two German astronomers. I get into that law in the second book, The Giza Death Star Deployed, and I explore it much further in the new book, The Cosmic War. Basically, it's a law that predicts on the basis of a harmonic arithmetic progression of the distance of the orbits of planets from the sun. And the astronomers at that time noticed that Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus all fell within the predictions made by this law, except that the law predicted precisely at the orbit of the asteroid belt the existence of a fairly large massed planet.
Indeed.
And this actually gave rise to the exploded planet hypothesis in the 19th century, the very early 19th century. And the astronomers even had a name for that planet, which I find is rather curious. They called it Krypton.
Ah, I see.
Ah, yeah. So now, you know, all the contemporary mythologies come a little closer to home.
Sure, absolutely. By the way, I have to ask you, have you heard about the work of Michael Tessarion? He discussed this basically exact idea in regards to that there was a second planet, or even in regards to how the planet was formed with full of water and so forth, that it actually was more like a second sun, basically. But, I mean, he discussed this idea and also ties in this, you know, that there actually was a warfare, or a war between the gods, as it were, that actually destroyed this planet.
Oh, yes, I'm very familiar with his work. And basically, my thinking is more or less the same as his. The thing that I add in the new book that's coming out, I mentioned it briefly in the last two Giza Death Star books as well, is that this missing planet, by all astronomical reckoning, would have been the same approximate mass as Saturn. But given the fact that the asteroid belt shows signs of having been fragments, or the debris field, as it were, of that planet, this was probably a solid planet, and it very likely was water-bearing. Now, in Van Flandern's speculation, the planet Mars may have actually been a satellite of this missing planet, and would account physics-wise for the eccentricity of Mars's orbit. And the other thing that an exploding planet, parent planet to Mars, would explain is the horrendously gouged and scarred nature of Mars's southern hemisphere, which geologists in the field will tell you has all the appearance of having been caused by sudden and massive flooding. So to put it somewhat differently, the best evidence for a planetary-wide conflagration and deluge of biblical proportions is actually on the planet Mars. So, you know, that opens up the whole other can of worms, and it's a can of worms I explore in the last of the Giza Death Star book, and in the new book, and that is the very strange associations that Mars has in human myth and lore,
yeah,
with warfare, with rebellion, and so on and so forth. So, you know, once we get into this scenario, we begin to see a lot of the connections beginning to make sense.
Indeed. I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, our ancient past and where, you know, where we actually might have come from and what
from,
actually
right.
is. Yeah,
well, you know, the American researcher into the Martian anomalies, Richard Hoagland.
Sure, indeed, yeah.
He has said on many occasions, and I just love this quotation, he has said, we may find out, after all, that we are the Martian.
Mm.
And,
indeed.
You know, that's a very succinct way of putting it.
Absolutely. And it's a bit, you know, it's in some sense even more, you know, thrilling, I guess, than you know, actually, you know, there being Martians in that sense, in some way.
Right, yeah. Right, because it raises the whole point of human origins again in another way. It doesn't so much question our ancient myths, the Sumerian myths or the biblical tales or so on, or the Hindu myths, but it does put them in an interpretive context that really, in a certain sense, shines a whole new light on all of these things.
Indeed, yeah.
So, you know, this is the scenario that I spend a great deal of time with in the new book. And one more thing I should point out.
Yeah.
If we speculate for a moment that this missing exploded planet is of the same approximate mass as Saturn, and if we speculate that it had intelligent life, human-like life, in all likelihood, that life would have been giant in stature.
Hmm.
So I get into the question in the new book of the evidences and remains of giants on the Earth as being possibly one of the ways or evidences that would corroborate this whole scenario. So it's a fascinating scenario from any way one approaches it.
Indeed, yeah, very fascinating. You know, do you think that someone dismantled the pyramid as a weapon?
Oh yes, absolutely. One of the things that Sitchin, in his book *The Wars of Gods and Men*, gets into, and I reproduce extensively in the Giza Death Star his text and his arguments, and really dissect it even to much greater detail in the new book that's coming out by consulting some Babylonian myths that he does not mention in his books.
Mm-hmm.
There is clear case of an inventory being taken of the components of an Akur, which is the Babylonian term for a ziggurat or a pyramid, after this war. And it's in a little Babylonian text called The Exploits of Ninurta.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read this text, your first impression is that, you know, what kind of myth is this? Because the text is nothing. It goes on for page after page of inventories of the names of various power stones.
Hmm. Okay.
And, you know, the text is nothing but which stone gets saved and which stone is destroyed and which stone is turned into uses for other purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me because it's exactly the type of thing that you would find done at the end of a hugely and horrendously destructive war by the victorious party. It's exactly the type of things that the Allies did to Germany at the end of World War II.
Hmm.
You know, you can develop this, but you can't develop that. We'll take this, you can have that. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So the whole context of it rings true from purely a political and scientific standpoint. So the pyramid, if we couple this text, and I make the case for doing so in the new book, if we couple this text to the clear indicators in the structure of the pyramid itself that items are indeed missing, then what we have is a clear indicator that this weapon was deliberately dismantled and destroyed. I even suggest in the Giza Death Star, the first book, that the structure was left standing as a kind of a monument or memorial of this war to warn people of what happens when sophisticated scientific technology is put into the hands or used for the purposes of evil.
Hmm. You know, I have to ask you, do you think that there could be any connection to the stolen objects from the, you know, looted museums in Baghdad during the early days. You know,
I knew you were going to come up with that.
You knew it.
I've had that question asked me before.
Sure.
There's an American author, a famous fellow by the name of Jim Mars.
Indeed. Talked to him yesterday, actually, but yeah.
Oh, excellent. Well, yeah. He's a friend of mine.
Yeah, okay, excellent, yeah.
He has written a new book on the problems with the official line in the 9/11 story called The Terror Conspiracy, and in it he speculates that the Baghdad Museum looting, he doesn't really speculate, he makes a very good case that this was a contrived incident, that it had all the appearances of being some sort of intelligence black bag operation.
Yeah.
And in my new book, I, independently of Jim mentioning this, because I didn't have his book at the time, and he and I had not really even talked about the subject, in the new book, I even mentioned this as a possibility, a hidden intelligence agenda at work with the American and British presence in Iraq.
Mm.
And one of the things I think kind of cinches that case is the fact that the French and the Germans particularly, had archaeological teams in Iraq at the behest of Saddam Hussein's government to precisely find some of these ancient sites and catalog their finds.
Mm.
So, you know, it's from if we take that speculation, it looks like two world powers have ganged up on two other world powers and kicked out one set of archaeologists and inserted another.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, could we speculate here then that someone actually is trying to, you know, reconstruct this, you know, the Giza Death Star, as it were?
Well, I can honestly say, in my opinion, I would say yes, because if, you know, just sitting where I sit, looking at all of this together, and incidentally, your listeners may think that there's not much of a connection between writing on Nazi secret weapons and bells and so on and so forth and ancient Egypt and ancient technology.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an exact correspondence, and there are little connections that I indicate in all the books between the two.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, yes, because if we go back to the Nazis for a moment, as we discussed in the first hour, one impetus for their physics theories, for their exploration of extremely avant-garde areas of scientific theory was precisely the occult, was precisely the esoteric or ancient texts.
Yeah.
And you yourself mentioned some of the ancient Sanskrit writings about Vimana and Mercury vortex propulsion and so on
sure.
and so forth.
Yeah.
These texts were clearly known to the Germans. I believe that Gerlach even alludes to them in that article that I mentioned.
Hmm.
It's also my belief, and I outline a case in the second two pyramid books, Deployed and Destroyed, that there appears to be a secret society interest in recovery of these ancient technologies and so on and so forth.
Indeed, yeah.
So it does not at all fall outside of the realm of my thinking that there is a hidden technological, very covert and very secret agenda at work in Iraq dealing with some of these ancient technologies.
Fascinating. And, we don't necessarily have to consider that there was some kind of activation of a weapon just because they're, you know, they in 2000 tried to, you know, cap the Great Pyramid in on New Year's Eve there and so forth, but they at that time at least didn't, you know, achieve that. I've heard about a great wall going up around the entire Giza plateau, and a lot of these, you know, sources that they're trying to shut off the area basically. Have you heard about this at all?
Oh yes, absolutely, and it's true. The Egyptian government is constructing a wall around the Giza plateau. And probably the spin that is put on it is that it's necessary to protect the site from potential vandalism or terrorism and things like that, which is certainly a legitimate concern. I'm not discounting that possibility.
No.
But, you know, the way these things work, once we get into it, I think, is that they work on many levels at the same time. I don't discount that the Iraq war is also for control of oil and
sure.
also for control of forward bases for the American and British military and some of their geopolitical interests in the region.
Indeed.
But by the same token, that does not discount the hidden agenda of a recovery or exploration of ancient technology.
No.
So I think the same thing is in play at Giza. I think that the Egyptian government is privately well aware, although they would never admit publicly, that this compound may indeed represent a technological artifact from a civilization that is much more ancient and probably much more sophisticated than ancient Egypt.
Do you think that the secrets, as it were, are you know, becoming more known to either to us or to those who actually are within the field of reconstructing this or researching these aspects?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Hmm. You know, if someone with basically a hobbyist interest in physics like me from the outback of South Dakota can figure out and piece some of these dots together, certainly someone with a formal background in ancient texts and ancient science and modern science could do so. And in fact, in this new book that I'm currently writing, not the one that's coming out, but the one I'm writing right now, there's every indication that in some of these research projects based on the physics articles I've looked at, that this is the case.
Fascinating. You know, I would love to have you back and talk about the new book, Cosmic War, when that is out. I mean, fascinating material. Yeah, I would love to do it again. I mean, I think that this is kind of a great place to round things off for this time. But I think that this has been an excellent interview. I would love to do it again. But again, before we finish things off, I would love if you could, you know, again, mention your Giza books and your Rite of the Black Sun and so forth, and how people can get them.
There's three books on the Giza Death Star weapon hypothesis. They're called The Giza Death Star, The Giza Death Star Deployed, and The Giza Death Star Destroyed. And then the two books on German secret weapons are called The Reich of the Black Sun and The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. They're all $16.95. There is a 10% discount if they order directly from the publisher, and the publisher can be reached at a toll-free number in the United States at 1-800-718-4514 or online at www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. That's all one word, and it's all lowercase. Alternatively, they can probably check it at any of the Amazon.com sites in their country, and the books would be available there.
Excellent. So everyone, AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com, or for Joseph Persson's website, GizaDeathStar.com. So again, Joseph, I mean, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a fabulous interview, and let's do it again, okay?
Oh, thank you very much for having me on, Henrik. It's been a lot of fun, and I look forward to doing it again.
Indeed. Thank you. Thank you so much for subscribing to Red Eyes Creations. We could not do this without your help and support.